Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast for November 16, 2009. My guest this week is William Mason, who is the general director of the Lyric Opera of Chicago. Welcome, Mr. Mason.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Great. Tell us about the great season you have going this year at the Lyric Opera.
Well, yeah, we're rather excited about it. We opened the season with some performances of Puccini's Tosca, and we will bring that back for six performances after the new year. We just closed a run of Gounod's Faust. That was a great success with a wonderful cast. We're in the middle of a run of Verdi's Ernani, an opera that comes from his early years that he referred to as his galley years, where he learned his craft. We're in rehearsal now for two shows, for Janáček's Katya Kabanova, and for The Merry Widow, which we'll be doing in English. It's Franz Lehár. Local Chicago director Gary Griffin will be directing The Merry Widow. After the holiday, we bring back some performances of Tosca, as I mentioned. New Donizetti's Elisir d'Amore, Berlioz's monumental Damnation of Faust, and close the season with one of the great operas of all time, Mozart's Marriage of Figaro.
Wow, what a season.
I'm having fun.
Yeah. And I thought Ernani was fantastic.
It's a wonderful piece. You know, it's once you get past the fact that it's a 19th century melodrama, there's a lot of wonderful music to be enjoyed. And when it's well sung as it is with this cast of people we've assembled, it becomes a very exciting event.
Yes, it certainly is. Okay, tell us now a little bit about your background, because your background in the history of the Lyric Opera kind of coincide to a certain extent.
Yes, indeed they do. I got interested in opera when I was about 9 years old because of the movie The Great Caruso with Mario Lanza. I joined the children's opera group, sang in the children's chorus here in the first few seasons of the company, sang a solo role in Tosca, a little shepherd boy who sings off stage. Started working backstage here while I was going to school. That was in 1962. Became an assistant stage manager in 68. And then over the next few years, did stage managing and assistant directing here and around the country. I was director of production here for 4 or 5 years. I went to San Francisco for a year and a half as artistic administrator. I came back in 1980 when my predecessor, Artis Krainik, took over, and I was head of artistic and production. And then when she passed on in 1977, I took over the company.
Wow.
In a nutshell.
So that's the condensed version.
That's the condensed version, yes.
But I mean, so you've had your hand on just about everything in creating an opera.
I've been involved in all aspects, pretty much, of the artistic and the production aspects of it, certainly. Yeah.
Wow. So what I've always impressed when I come to see the operas here is it's although the music is so important, the singing and the music, it's the whole spectacle, the storytelling.
It is a remarkable thing. There's really nothing quite like it. There's so much that can go wrong. I mean, you've got singing, you know, you've got with a chorus, and you've got an orchestra, and you've got singers, and then you've got, oftentimes you have dancers, you have scenery, obviously lighting, costumes. But when it all works, there's really nothing quite like it. It is a combination of all the arts, you know, the visual, the musical, and it's terribly exciting.
Yes, it is. And what I find is all these elements coming together that even if it isn't in English, it's not a problem. You actually stop reading the translations because you start following it.
We do have the surtitles over the over the stage, the proscenium, which give a pretty accurate translation of what's going on stage, which has been a great boost to opera here and all over the country, and actually all over the world. In many of the European theaters, they were sort of slow to take to it, having had its origins here in the States. So it took them a while, but right now there's very few companies in the world that don't have titles.
Yeah, I would think so, because you can follow it to a certain extent, but you read maybe the first line or two. I know I stopped in Ernani. I stopped reading it.
Sure.
Maybe a little bit when a new scene would happen, just to get a feel for where it's at, but you follow it.
Well, in Ernani, I mean, I love the music, but the story, again, is, as I say, highly melodramatic, and to miss some of the words is not a serious matter as it might be in something that had a little more content to it.
Yeah.
But again, there's like a lot of things, you have to suspend disbelief. You know, and I look at some of the stuff I see in movies or on television, and it's equally impossible and unlikely, but it's a convention that we accept today. These are conventions that were accepted in the 1840s. In the particular case of Hernani, this incredibly overdeveloped sense of honor with a capital H. These are attitudes that don't exist today. They seem foolish to us, but today's attitudes in movies and theaters will probably seem just as out of date in 50 or 100 years.
Yeah. So it's
a look back in history. It's a look back in theatrical history in many ways. So many of the operas that are being there, based, many of them are based on plays. The Serenade was based on a well-known play by Victor Hugo. Most operas are 19th century operas are based on either history or plays or novels.
So similar to the Broadway musicals, yeah. Many of those were from another source.
Yeah.
All right. Give us an idea on what it takes to put a production together.
Well, when you put a production together, because of the supply of major singers is unfortunately much less than the demand for their services, you're planning seasons 4 and 5 years in advance. That's true now of the major directors. So you're really talking about assembling a director and designer team and a cast that far in advance.
Wow.
You start talking, especially with the production itself, you talk with the director and establish certain parameters of how the company envisions the work and how the director may envision the work. Sometimes you find you're not in the same wavelength, and so you part ways. But you start off, we have to have some kind of an aesthetic meeting of the minds as to what this thing should be. What should it look like? What do we not want it to look like? And after that, it's a developmental process, as it is in any form of theater, with the director and his design team putting something together, having their separate meetings. They come back to us generally a year or so before the season in which the production is appearing. We have preliminary design meetings where we make sure that we are more or less aesthetically on the right page. And no less importantly is to make sure that financially we can afford to do the production. We can afford the mounting costs. We can afford the crew costs that will be inherent in its running and all that sort of stuff. So there's a strong financial aspect to it.
So these aren't necessarily tours, like a Broadway show would come and do a national tour?
No. This is, in many cases, we do co-productions with other companies, and so we'll either be the first producer of it or the second or the third, or we rent things from other places. But when we're doing a new production on our own, that's the process that goes through. Now, hopefully, we hope that some other company will rent the production, and we get revenue from that. But by and large, when we do new productions, we want to shepherd it through. We might want to make sure that the production, that the production represents the aesthetic values, whatever such as they are, of this company, and it will be something that we feel our public will enjoy.
Well, you guys do a magnificent job.
We try. Thank you.
Yeah. And a lot of people wonder why the tickets can be expensive for the shows, but I always tell them it's all relative to what you get.
Well, there's no question. Opera is a very expensive form of entertainment when you consider the forces that you've got. You have an orchestra that averages, a regular orchestra is 76 people. Sometimes you need extras for big Wagner operas. Chorus is 48 people, though you often augment that. You've got 40 to 50 stagehands working on a show, 15, 20 dressers, wig people, you got a production staff, you got a music staff, and that's just the people working on the show, not counting the administrative staff. So it's we're very labor intensive. 70 to 75% of the total budget of the company is paying people. That means administration and all the artists.
I didn't realize it was epic. I'm always amazed by how you do the set changes as quick as you do, and they're like, they're breathtaking almost to the shows.
We got a terrific crew. I mean, who does it? Who works very hard? But there's a lot of time. A lot of that much of those problems have to be solved again in the design process. And that's why sometimes during the course of design, you might say to somebody, yeah, we like the look of it, and it's not that it's that expensive, but this is going to be a hell of a scene change, or this is going to be the act change will be too long, or can we do something to make that easier? Because those are all the sorts of things that you have to think about when you're planning it.
Okay. This may seem obvious to you, but to me and some of our listeners, it might not be. The arrangements of the music in an opera, are those pretty well set pieces, or does the conductor from one production to another do different arrangements?
No, the in any of the standard operas, the music has been composed and orchestrated by the composer. The option that the company or the conductor has is to perhaps make certain cuts, which is not infrequently done in some of the earlier operas. There's a lot of cutting done in Handel. And any of the repertoire, there's potential for cuts. There are certain little passages for singers that they can do differently. Sometimes the composers have actually even written optional lines for the singers in some cases. But by and large, the wishes of the composer, certainly musically, are what you want to follow.
Wow. That's impressive. So that's one of the things you have to follow, so people know that.
You have to follow. One of the issues that comes up today that I find a little annoying when people try to impose the composer's intentions when it comes to staging and to stagecraft, because we won't begin to know what the composer would have intended had he had today's technology available to him, when you need to do something new theatrically with pieces in many cases. But we certainly always respect the composer's musical intentions.
So therefore, then you have to find certain singers that can sing certain roles.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of singers around, and you know, there's certain roles that are tougher to find singers for than others. Some of the big Wagnerian roles, there's a limited number of people. There's a lot of people who can sing some of the Mozart stuff, but you're always just trying to find the best.
Yeah, and those decisions, is that made by you, by the director, or how does that process?
Well, ultimately, as general director, I suppose I have the final say, so I sign the contracts. But it's a very collaborative endeavor. We are blessed to have Sir Andrew Davis as our music director. And so Andrew and a wonderful director of artistic administration, Andy Melnott, our director of operations, Nick Martin, and we have a European consultant, Ava Maria Wieser. These are the five of us. Plan seasons, you know, put ideas out there, you know, argue, discuss back and forth, and remarkably come up with a fairly common idea of what we should be doing in any given season.
Well, that begs the question that I told you I would be asking mm-hmm. about. How do you balance doing the chestnuts, the well-known operas that your audiences love, with daring new work to expand the art? How do you balance that?
Well, that's the interesting and the fun part of the job, is trying to do that. You know, we only do eight operas a year, so it's tough to think of having a complete balance in any one given season. We tend to look at three consecutive seasons and make sure that there's a nice smattering of what we feel to be the sort of the essential operas for the public to see. But in any given season, we'll do two or three of the barn burners, like Carmen, Bohème, Tosca. We'll maybe do one or two of the things that are more esoteric, a little out of the way. And then the rest of it is kind of balanced off with repertory pieces that perhaps are not the big favorites, but that should be repeated every so often. Sometimes you do certain things as vehicles for singers. So it's just kind of a whole process that we've managed to, we have our own way of doing it, and so far it works for us.
How do you, I guess it has worked, because isn't it, did I read where it's 20 out of 21 or 20?
Well, we were.
That you've been in the black?
We've been in the black, yes.
Which you are to be commended for that, because performing arts organizations around the world are all struggling.
Well, I think it's part of this, the inheritance of this company. It's sort of inbred into the company. I had a remarkable predecessor, a woman by the name of Artis Krainik, who began to run this company in a business-like manner. That doesn't necessarily mean running it like a business, but it certainly means paying attention to the finances and not spending money you don't have, which is where some organizations maybe occasionally get themselves in trouble.
Yeah, and could it be also to doing too many shows that maybe the public might not want in some theater groups?
That, yeah, in some cases, having more product than the public wants, not giving them what they want, not doing it at the level they want, not promoting it well enough, whatever. But we have a remarkable board, a remarkable staff.
And you do surveys to your audiences?
We do. Yeah, we did a survey last year, I guess it wasn't. We had done one maybe, I don't know, 3 or 5 years before that. You get some idea of what it is they like, what it is they don't like. You can't slavishly adhere to them. But on the other hand, when you see that there's a large segment of your public that doesn't like something, Well, you don't do it so often, or you don't do it at all. But sometimes there are works that are difficult, that are thorny, but they need to be done. A case in point was the Lulu by Alban Berg that we did last year. It's an atonal piece. It's a long, it's a murky drama, but it's a great piece of theater. And people who came to it were knocked out by it. It was a wonderful evening.
Well, you're to be commended for that, because we need, you know, that's some of my argument with the Broadway musical, and sometimes even with television is that they pander down to the audiences rather than being uplifting and pulling their audiences up with them.
It's a tricky business, because ultimately, you know, you can't serve liver if people don't want to eat liver. But you do have to find a way of, as you say, stretching things a little bit, whether it's in the operas that you do or the nature of the productions that you do.
Wow. Evan, you had a question?
Yeah, I was particularly interested in what the Met has been doing with the HD broadcasts, and I'm sure you're following that, so I was wondering if you had any thoughts about that.
Well, I think what they do brilliantly. Whether or not it's helping companies or hurting companies, it's just too soon to tell, particularly in this economy. Some of the smaller companies, I think, around the country are worried that, you know, because of the price difference between a theater, you know, an opera ticket or a movie ticket, they might lose some business. But they do it brilliantly. And, you know, the thing that I have, and I, this is just my own personal thing, I'm not a big fan of opera on TV or opera in the theater, because basically I want to look where I want to look. I don't want to have the camera tell me where I have to look.
I agree. But that's the same problem with live videoing a Broadway performance.
Yeah. I mean, I want to be able to pick and choose where I, you know, put my eyes. But they do it brilliantly.
Is there any plans of...
No, there'd be no plans for us to do it. First of all, the Metropolitan is a unique organization. It's the only classical performing musical organization that has a nationwide following by virtue of the fact they've been on the radio for almost 80 years. Even any of the great symphonies, Chicago Symphony, BSO, none of them have that same kind of national outreach. So they're the only ones who can command a nationwide audience. They've got the financial resources. I think it's foolish for anybody else to try to compete with them on that level. And to do one every few years, it's not worth it. I'm happy to. I wish them every success with it. I'm delighted they're doing it. But I think we'll leave that field to them.
Okay. That's a great answer. So tell us now what you're doing to bring younger audiences in to see the magic of opera.
Well, we have a wonderful program we initiated about 2, 3, maybe 4 years ago now, called Next. And there are a large number, as we all know, of colleges and universities within the Chicagoland area. And I think over 150, 180 of them have signed up. And so anybody, any degree-seeking student at one of those colleges or universities can register with us online. When we have single tickets for a performance, we send out an email blast, and they can buy tickets for $20. Now, this is limited to the student themselves. It's not to buy tickets for their parents or this and that. They've got to come and show their ID. But we sold 7,000 of those things last year, and it's wonderful, because you get an audience that is young, enthusiastic, and vocal about it. They're not people, they don't sit on their hands. They make noise when they like it. And they come without any preconceptions. It's not, you know, the last time I saw La Boheme, the table was over there, so that's where it should be this time. They're totally open for what it is they see. So it's a thrilling audience for us to have.
Wow. You know, the second opera I saw last year, there was a young man sitting in one of the prime seats, and I was kidding him. I said, how could you afford, you know, because it was, you know, it was opening night and prime ticket. And he said they have a special program. And now you're explaining. And he did have that enthusiasm. He educated me about the opera. He had heard it and read it, but he was just blown away by it.
You know, I think everybody bemoans the fact there's not music education, arts education, or in some cases, who knows what else there isn't in public schools these days. But that's harmful. But I think that if people have a chance to get exposed to it, not everybody's going to like it. But for many people, it's an enormously rewarding and enriching experience. And I think that experience is still open to those people of any age who, as I say, had the chance to
So they
to
go
be
on the Lyric Opera of Chicago's website.
Right.
And what do they look for?
I was afraid you asked me because I'm not very website savvy, but I think it's fairly easy to find. I'll bet you.
And your site's very easy now.
It'll say next. It might be under education. I'm embarrassed. I don't know.
But no, it's all right.
But not that embarrassed. they can find it on the website. They can register. And as I say, when we have the tickets, they'll get an email blast.
Well, that's true. And you said 7,000 last year?
7,000 tickets last year, yeah.
Great. Well, you don't want an empty seat. That doesn't do you any good.
No, not at all. Not at all. And as I say, these are the audience of the future. You're trying to develop future audiences at a lot of different levels. Obviously, you're going to the schools. It would be nice if we could get into the schools more often. But
you do go into the – what do you do?
We have a couple of programs. We have a program particularly called Opera in the Neighborhoods where we get a group of six or seven young singers. We take a popular repertory opera, condense it to 45, 50 minutes, do it in English, very simple sets. They go out with, they're just a piano. And we'll go to one of the schools that has a slightly larger auditorium, but then some of the students from other schools in that area will be bussed in. And so they perform the opera, and there's a question and answer period afterward. But, I mean, because of all the testing and all the other stuff that gets done in schools these days, our window of opportunity to get into schools is only about 6 weeks or so in October. And it's a pity because it would be a wonderful program that should be done, yeah. I think,
yeah, so the,
year-round.
The bureaucracies at the school kind of slow that up a little bit.
Well, it's all about, I guess, testing these days.
Oh, it's all about,
It's all about testing.
Well, what good is it if people learn to read if there's nothing to read? They can develop taste and they can't hear or see anything.
Yeah, don't get me started on all that. But it's, yeah, no, I think it's,
I think we're on the same page.
I would think so.
That's terrific because we're starting to do that in theater, in some of the theater groups. And it's really great to hear that you guys are.
You know, we bring students in. We do two student matinees in the house every year. And with a remarkable thing about that, one of the things that particularly the younger audiences are so deeply impressed by is that they find it amazing that people stand on the stage of this 3,500-seat opera house and sing unamplified, and their voices project. Yes. I mean, they're really blown away by that.
Yeah, well, I am too. And that's why I'm so – you made me – so tough on small theater groups when I hear these actors who can't project even dialogue in a room not much bigger than when the room we're in here.
I would think that's a problem in theater too, people who apparently don't learn to project the voice as they must have done some years ago.
Yeah, and even if they're mic'd, you can't hear them because the mic only can pick up what you're giving it. So if you're not projecting, but you're right, the magic. And is that what you would consider one of the differences between in opera and in shows like Les Mis the sung through Broadway shows? So I was asking a couple of people the questions of that, and I guess it begs the other question, will you guys eventually be doing shows like Les Mis?
You know, I think we have to do the shows in our season that we can do well, and I don't know that a show like Les Mis is something that, given our forces, is something that we do as well as others. We also have to consider our own audience and what they want to see. And by and large, for better or worse, I'm not sure that the operatic public entirely buys into the idea of doing musical theater works on a regular basis. We'll find, we did Porgy last year very, very successfully.
Awesome.
We have another work in plan for a season a few years down the road, and we'll see how that goes.
You did Sweeney Todd.
We did Sweeney Todd. We've done Candide. We did Street Scene. Some of those works border more on the operatic. Almost all of them really do because of the natures of the voices.
Well, the Porgy and Bess, the opera version.
Porgy and Bess is an opera. There has recently been, I think Trevor Nunn just recently did a more music theater version. But, it's an opera. But again, some of the musicals that were written pre-1960s, the Kiss Me Kates of the world, the Rodgers and Hammersteins, the Showboats, the Kern. This kind of stuff lends itself to being sung by operatic-type voices. When you get past a certain point in the 60s, these are not necessarily operatic voices that are required. Yeah. So it doesn't mean that we can't do pieces like that using non-operatic people, but whether or not it's a good idea for us to be doing that just still remains to be seen as we look forward.
Okay. Well, that's a good... Yeah. So the early shows are still, because they're almost operettas.
Yeah, they are. I mean, the Rodgers and Hammerstein stuff. I mean, you've got to be able to obviously have singers who can speak. I mean, that helps too. But there's a vocal requirement for many of those pieces that you just can't have actors if they can't sing.
Well, the tour that's coming here from South Pacific has the I'm blanking on his name, the gentleman from
Paul
that did Tosca.
Paul. Oh.
Petterman or blanking. He's on the national tour of South Pacific.
Oh, is he? Okay, so I saw the fellow in New York.
He did Tosca at the Met, I guess.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it rings a bell, and I can't think of name either. But, yeah, but that's the part. I mean, the part in Emile de Bec in South Pacific was premiered by Ezio Pinza. Pinza, at that point, you know, was slightly past his prime, but he had been the great operatic bass in the world in the 20s, 30s, even into the 40s. So I think when South Pacific premiered, maybe it was 46 or somewhere around there. As I say, he was not what he had been 10, 15 years earlier, but that was still a major operatic singer.
Oh, yeah. So you see the balance is there.
Yeah.
So give us an idea of some of the things you guys have planned, since you said you're 4 or 5 years in advance. I mean, you don't have to necessarily name names, because I know until the deals are done.
Well, you know, we're looking at a lot of things down the road. I tell you, one of the things I'm very excited about that we've already announced for next year is that the season in 2010 will open with a new production of Verdi's Macbeth with Barbara Gaines staging and directing it.
Very
exciting. And Barbara and I have been having lunch for years, a couple times a year, talking about what we might or might not do together. And then, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago, we came upon this. And it's a very exciting project.
She stages her Shakespeare.
She's a
fantastic,
wonderful director. And it's an interesting experience for her because it'll be the first time doing an opera. There's a whole different set of conditions that exist in doing an opera, whether it's some of the union regulations involved, just the whole nature of the work, the fact that you also have a collaborator in the conductor who is no less important than the director. Whereas as a director in the theater, you're pretty much, you know, I mean,
you're Barbara's kind of the boss, right?
Yeah, Barbara's a very collaborative person in any case. Yeah. But sometimes for other theater directors coming in, finding out there's this shared authority, well, they're bright enough to realize if they don't want to do that, they don't accept the job, I guess. But still, when you actually get into it. So there's a number of things that we're looking at down in the future. I guess none of them I'm allowed to say.
Okay.
But we will be doing interesting work with great singers. Ultimately, in the final analysis, you've got to have the great singers. You've got to have the great music. And because even when you hire a stage director, the best stage directors in the world have had flops. There's not anybody, whether you know Sir Peter Hall or, you know, or anybody you pick, these people, you know, have things that are not successful. When you hire a good cast of singers and a major conductor, you can be a little bit more assured that it's going to be great. A singer can have an off night, but still.
How's been your success at getting the top singers?
Yeah.
Do they like coming here?
They like coming here. They like the city. They like the company. And so we have success with that. And then you get, as I say, interesting directors. And, or you see a production, a lot of times, you know, we're not the only company that does good work. So you see a production sometimes in another city that was brilliantly directed. And you say, I'd like to bring that to Chicago. So you
do that. You go
we
see
do
any
that.
Other works.
You go see something someplace else and you rent the production and you bring it here. You know, obviously you might not have the same cast, but you get the same scenery, the whole production, and then you get the director to come and then redirect it with a potentially different cast.
Okay, one of the questions that a couple of people asked me to ask you was why in shows like Faust and Tosca, some of the shows you have a different cast, is that logistics or is that to save their voice? Or
it can be a couple of things. In the case of something like Tosca, an opera popular enough so that you can do 12 performances of it, a lot of singers don't necessarily want to do something 12 times in a row.
Oh.
It means them being here a great deal of time. And from a scheduling standpoint, sometimes it's tough since we're in a repertory system to run something out for 12 performances. So it lends itself very nicely to having two different casts, so you can bring just a few more people for the public to discover here. So we had an excellent cast, an opening cast that was perhaps a little more familiar to the public with Debbie Voigt, Jim Morris, and Vladimir Galuzin. The next cast doing it in January will be a cast a little bit less familiar to our public, but no less good, and it gives us the opportunity to bring those folks into us.
So I guess that begs the question of How many days off to, for their voices to do they need? Because you don't run them Friday, Saturday,
Sunday. Anywhere, you know, certain lighter things, they can have one day off in between, so they can do it on a Monday and a Wednesday. The general rule would be 2 days off, but some of these big Wagner things or some of these big things, 3 days off. So if you do it on a Monday, the next time is a, you know, is a Friday. But as to why we do it for something like Faust, you know, sometimes you do an opera, you want to do 10 performances of it, but the singer you really, you know, your sort of your first choice for it is only available for 6 or 8 or something like that. So you don't just say, well, we won't hire him at all. You say, okay, well, we'll take him for that number of performances and we'll get somebody very solid, very good for the other 2, 3, or 4.
That's needed. I needed that explanation.
You got it.
I wasn't sure how that would go. That's great. You have Evan. You have another question.
I was curious to know if some of your programming decisions were made with balancing out the older crowd and the younger crowd, having something for everybody.
I think that's somewhat inherent in the process. You know, we do certain. It's interesting. You do certain things, like as I mentioned, the Carmens, the Bohems, the Toscas. You want to do them frequently enough so that some of the people who've never heard them before will have a chance to hear them. At the same time, if you do them every other year, every 3 years, you're going to, you know, sort of annoy the people who've already seen them 10 times. So it really sort of lies with repertoire that some of the newbies will be wanting to see, with some of the older stuff, the different stuff that some of your regulars have not seen for some time. Either they haven't seen for some time, or they haven't seen for some time, so they're more than happy to welcome it back. And it's mainly that. I don't, from an aesthetic standpoint, you sometimes the nature, some of the productions, there's a lot more outlandish, unusual productions, deconstructionist, whatever. In Europe, some of this stuff gets referred to as Eurotrash, which is perhaps not a fair term, but there's such a different aesthetic. So some of that stuff you might bring over here with an idea that maybe the younger audience might accept. But you're, at the same time, have to be leery that it doesn't alienate your old-timers.
Yeah, you're the base.
Yeah.
All right, my final question, this is one I ask just about everybody.
Okay.
What are some of the goals that you haven't accomplished or that you would like to do or some of the things you'd like to do in the future? Because obviously you love what you're doing.
I do. At this point in my career and my age, I look towards, at some point, handing the company over to someone else who will continue to have it prosper and flourish. There's certain artistic things that I'd like to do. You know, I've done a lot of the stuff that I would like to do, and now it's a question of what's good for the company. Somewhere down the road, the company should do another ring cycle. There's a lot of works that I can identify that I think the company should do, I would like to see them do.
Is there one in particular that you haven't done?
You know, I have to say the stuff that I really like, at some point in my life, we've done it. There's certain things like Falstaff and the Marriage of Figaro. We could do those every year as far as I'm concerned. But I think the next best thing for this company will be to get a new ring cycle, maybe hopefully by the end of the next decade, or some point in that time. It's just, I wish that these were a little different economic times, but things will get better. And then I think at that point, the company grows in ways that are yet to be seen with a new audience and new leadership.
Well, thank you so much. And I'm sure that you have stimulated enough interest in some of our younger audiences too. Well,
I certainly
hope
so.
To go on the site, especially if they can get an inexpensive ticket.
Absolutely. Right? $20. You can't beat it.
Yeah. But if you can beg, borrow, or steal for some of the shows coming up, I can't wait for The Merry Widow.
The Merry Widow is going to be great. You know, we got something opening on the 22nd of November, the Katya Kabanova. It's a remarkable piece, and particularly for people interested in the theater, it's a very strong, compelling opera dramatically. It's based on the Ostrovsky play called The Storm. It's a rather dark piece. It's Czech with a, I think the story is Russian, though. But it's a powerful drama, and we have a great, great protagonist, Carita Matalo, a great singing actress. So it's on theatrical terms, it will be an event worth attending.
Great. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And folks, go see a play this week, and go see an opera, too. Thank you.